Welcome back to the Maladising Show. We're Shirley and Sharon Nordrum, and today we're up at the Watermark Art Center listening to a talk by Kent Estee called Picking Sweetgrass with Ma. This was a great talk, and we're happy to be able to bring you this show for the folks that couldn't be there to hear it in person. Make much for listening.
Welcome to the Watermark. Welcome to Picking Sweetgrass with Ma. I want to thank you all for being here. This is a very exciting evening for us. Kent Estee is an amazing person, and I have to tell a little intro of I was told about Kent when I was working over at Gazigan Arts Incubator, and somebody said, "Have you seen my uncle's work?" And I'm like, "No," and they had up some picture, and it was his representation work, and I said, "Wow, this guy's really good. I'd love to meet him sometime." And I don't know, I think it was probably about another year before we connected. But Kent is a fellow White Earth member of the White Earth Ojibwe Nation, born and raised and lived in Natawash all of his life, teaches at the school. He went to school at BSU, he attended BSU for college, and it was real interesting this summer when he was exhibiting up at the NWICDC, he encountered and caught up with some of his friends from Upward Bound, so, which was really
a long time ago.
So I think that Kent is really admired and appreciated in his community for many, many things, as well as his talent as an artist. He helped establish the charter school, going strong in Natawash, in his community. I think he has a number of siblings. There's a very artistic family, very well-known family. Kent he's going places. He has this exhibit here. He's got an exhibit that's going up down in Minneapolis, and a man whose work that needs to be seen is going out into the world. I really admire Kent. I'm really honored that we get to have him here featuring his work and having this talk, and I'm going to turn it over to you.
Thank you. Okay, thank you for coming. Wow, I didn't expect this. I knew a couple family members would come to hiss and boo, but I didn't expect all the rest of you, so thank you for coming. It's a really beautiful day. Finally, it's not snowing, right? So I'm glad you came. And I get an opportunity that I've wanted a long, long time to do. I get to talk about my grandmother. And also I get to talk about her art. And you can see, here's some of her basketry here. These are her baskets. And one of the predominant ways to recognize her baskets was because of the sweetgrass. And we're gonna talk about that later. We're gonna hear a short little story about picking sweetgrass with Ma. Over here, these baskets it wasn't just my grandmother who makes black ash baskets. Her son, Tiny, and my grandmother, and my father also made black ash baskets. He learned from my grandmother. And my brother, who's sitting way in the back over there, he's also a black ash basket maker, and other members of the family as well. So it's been handed down from generation to generation, which is really cool. So Mad Wei Wei, it is her. It's all about speaking as an artist. People speak different ways. They express their emotions through their art. Some of the pieces that you'll see, hopefully you'll take some time and you'll go through the exhibits in the museum here. Take some time to do that. I hope you brought your checkbook. Lori had me say that. So. But I hope you enjoy what's here. And it's such an honor to be a part of this current exhibit. It's wonderful. It's wonderful. What an opportunity to have that here and in this community and in this region. Whether it be painting, music, drama, or weaving, artists find a way to tell their stories. They really do. My grandmother, she sold her baskets. When she first started making baskets, she sold them just for pennies. pennies. And then later on, they were selling those same little baskets, they're selling for $50, $60 or more. And she was always amazed at the price of her baskets, because she would say, you know, they're just baskets. But they were beautiful. And she never considered herself an artist, but she really truly was. She was the first artist that I ever knew personally. And then she was, of course, my grandmother. But also she was a historian, and she had a story to tell. And we're going to talk a little bit about that tonight. This piece that you can see here is called Tribal Memories. And this actually came about because Karen Goulet, last summer, we were in a class. She was teaching a wonderful class about Indian business development. And we were talking about my grandmother's influence on what I do today. She said, you really need to honor your grandmother by doing something. So when I heard the theme of this exhibit, it is heard, this is the result of those efforts. So this collage is really there to honor my grandmother. This news article that you'll see on the piece, this was written in 1978. It was part of the Minneapolis Star and Tribune. It was a Sunday section, pull-out section. My grandmother, she primarily received recognition first because of her basketry, and then the history that she had or held. She would be interviewed many, many times by reporters over the years because of her basketry, but also she had a really poignant story to tell and share with people. She lived at the turn of the century, the 19th century, when life was extremely hard for Native people and especially children. My grandmother would weave, and she would tell her stories. Some of her words were very hard to hear because there was a lot of loss during that time. And we're going to talk a little bit about that loss that she experienced. But you know, despite all the loss, there was this resilience. And that's what I want you to remember tonight. Not all these hard words to hear, but the resilience of her and other Native people. Because you know what? We're still here. We made it. We're still here. Some of us have a lot of trauma because of the past, but we're still here despite the losses. Because she lived a life without regrets. And I don't remember anger being there despite all the things that she'd gone through. She was born at a time when traditions, language, and culture had been shamed and beat out of the people. A common phrase at the time was, kill the Indian and save the man. The words were spoken by Colonel Richard Pratt. He founded the Carlisle Indian Boarding Schools, where she would eventually attend. So for a few minutes tonight, what we're going to do, with your help, and I've asked some people in the audience to read for me tonight, we're going to read some of her words from this 1978 article. And also, we're going to actually hear her voice from a recording that was done back in the 60s by a professor who was studying Native American history. So, Picking Sweetgrass with Ma, at the end of this presentation, we're going to, you're going to hear that personal little story that was written about 20 years ago as part of my master's thesis. And I want to share with you that story tonight. And I want to share her baskets with you because they're beautiful. My grandmother was an artist. There's her basketry. Aren't they beautiful? She never called herself an artist. She was just a basket maker. But she was very, very particular about how her baskets were created. If it wasn't just right, she'd tear it apart, start all over again. Okay? She respected her art. She really did. And she took her time with each basket. And a lot of times, she would use a scissors to cut each splint.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So it took a lot of time. Very particular about what she did. My grandmother's basketry really didn't become popular until she was in her 70s and 80s. And by that time, she couldn't keep up with the orders. She would demonstrate her baskets at Itasca State Park in the summer, and eventually she showed her baskets and demonstrated her work at the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C. She told a story of another grandmother that was on that went with her to Washington, D.C., who was 70 years old, and she was making quilts. And the people were commenting, they said, isn't grandma doing really well for 70? And my grandmother said, heck, she's just a kid, I'm in my 80s. So that's the type of personality she had. The baskets that she used to sell for 35 cents were now selling for $50 or more. Over the years, my wife Becky is sitting right here. We would travel to museums, one of my favorite things to do, all across the United States. And her baskets would show up. They'd be there. What a surprise. It was always a surprise because we never knew. But there it was. There was her baskets. It was always an unexpected surprise. A couple of years ago, we went to Phoenix. And on our list of adventures was going to the Heard Museum. And in the Heard Museum, there was one of her baskets. And also there was a display presentation about boarding schools. It was called Away From Home, the Boarding School Experience. So as we went through this display, it was very, very powerful, very overwhelming. And then my wife says, Kent, come here. I walked into the room. She said, look, on the wall in that classroom was a quote from my grandmother. I couldn't talk a word of English. All I talked was the Ojibwe language. Josephine Robinson, Ojibwe, Pipestone Indian School. That was a surprise. And this one set me back. I don't remember too much more of the exhibit after that. It was pretty hard to see because this was very, very overwhelming. Her words are powerful. As I went back through the newspaper articles about her life and preparing this collage, these words jumped out of the page at me. You always run across people who make you understand you're just an Indian. You're just an Indian. Those words is what resulted in this piece that I did in honor of her. It was then that I knew that I wanted to do this in honor of her and for her, and create, using her words, this piece of art. So Josephine Robinson, she never wanted to be called Grandma. It was just Ma, nothing else. It was Ma. She was born in 1893. These were hard times for Native Americans, especially the children. She was born at a time when the White Earth Reservation had just been established. Her family was one of the first to settle on the reservation. She lived in a time when families lived off the land, lived by the lake. They were in the woods. They trapped, they hunted, they fished, and they lived a really simple, simple life.
People always went by the seasons. Mrs. Robinson said, not by the date or the year. I was born on the full moon during rice making. My sister was born when the crows come in the spring. Jacob Redbird was born, they say, when the buds were forming on the trees. It must have been March. One of my cousins was born when the crabapple blossoms were blooming.
It's a simple life. The Warren family lived in one of the first homes in the Natahwash community. Her family had a farm that included a blacksmith shop, a carpentry shop, and even a granary, they say. Her father, Tyler Warren, was also the manager and part owner of the Buffalo Bill Wild West show.
Buffalo Bill was down here. I forget what year that was, but he came down here and visited my people. I remember him because he, you could come and help me on his stuff, but I remember that. And he knew my grandfather real well because he used to travel with us. He used to take a bunch of Indians from here and travel in his show. And he just happened to be in town. And so I told her, I said, let's walk downtown. I said, I'd like to see. We used to call him Bigelow when we were kids. That's what we called us, and then we had him, Bigelow. And I don't know why we called him that. Maybe we couldn't pronounce him Buffalo or something. But that's the name we gave it.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, that's the guy who might see Bigelow, I said. She heard a lot about him too, but she didn't really know him. When we was walking across the street, we see that man standing across the street from us with his long hair and long coat.
Mm-hmm.
I said, there he is. I said, there's Bigelow. And she just stopped, you know, and you see him come right across the street to us.
Mm-hmm.
He says, Indian girls, he says, he shook hands with us. And then he tried to ask us who we were, where we're from, who our people were. Or he was asking her, and I was just waiting it all in. So he turned around to me, and I told him my father was Tyler Warren. He just grabbed me. He says, I know you. He said, well, he used to call me Jesse as a little girl, you know. He called me Jesse. You're a little Jesse, he says. He was so glad to see me.
Her father, Tyler Warren, would die at an early age. He drowned at the age of 54. She was just 4 years old. Her mother, Ellen, would remarry a man called Star Bad Boy. My grandmother lived in a time when the federal government had taken away her religious freedoms. In 1875, the government had banned all drumming, singing, dancing for anyone 50 years and younger. Why? Because they thought and knew that when the elders died, the practices would also. For the most part, it worked. The federal government banned all ceremonies in the late 1800s and early 1900s. In 1882, the Commissioner of Indian Affairs wrote a letter expressing the United States government policy towards Indian religious freedom.
There's no good reason why Indians should be permitted to indulge in practices which are repugnant to common decency and morality. The preservation of good order on reservations demands of me active measures to be taken to discourage and, if possible, put a stop to the demoralizing influence of heathenish rites, Price's letter said.
The Anishinaabe people at the time were called pagans. According to one of our white tribal historians, violators on the White Earth Reservation were punished under regulations that were called Indian offenses. Food rations were held. People were jailed. Children as young as 4 were taken from their parents and sent to government boarding schools. Indian spirituality and culture went underground. The White Earth Reservation was typical of what happened across all of the United States. It wasn't just White Earth.
I don't know why they should call an Indian a pagan, because an Indian never was a pagan.
No,
they
all
believed in God.
Yeah.
We were taught that from the time we were children.
Yeah.
And respect for everything. Nature. You know, believing in the Holy Spirit. But I learned, they always say, call us Indians peggies.
Growing up, my grandmother lived a really simple life. She was a member of a well-respected family. All of nature and land were respected. It was part of who they were and who she was as a Native person.
We were taught not to even mark the trees. They were put there by the Holy Spirit. The old people believed there was a spirit in everything. We lived by a creek. We were not allowed to throw anything dirty in the creek or on the lakeshore. We were taught to have respect for water.
My grandmother lived at the time when Congress had authorized the Commissioner of Indian Education or Indian Affairs to create legal rules that required Indian children to attend boarding schools. During these years, Indian agents forcibly abducted children as young as 4 from their homes and enrolled them in Christian and government-run boarding schools. In 1902, my grandmother would begin her formal education in the first Minnesota Indian boarding school in White Earth. It was a tough school, a really tough school. This was one of 16 boarding schools across the state of Minnesota. In 1902, when she was there, White Earth had room for 102 students.
I was 9 years old and I was punished all the time. They used to put me in the corner. Why? Because I didn't know English. They'd ask me a question. I didn't answer. They thought I was stubborn. They put me in the corner. At the time, I didn't know they were punishing me. I didn't know one word of English.
Sometimes we were strapped. We had to march in step. Everywhere we went, we had to be in line. It was just like military school. Everything had to be on time. She was 9. After a few years in White Earth, she moved on and left the reservation to attend Pipestone Indian Trade School to finish her grade school education. She was only allowed to come home on the extended holidays during that time. In 1909 and 10, my grandmother left the reservation and went off to another government boarding school in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. This was the model. This was the model for American Indian boarding schools. The Carlisle Indian School was founded in 1879. It was in an abandoned army post in Pennsylvania. They say the goal, ultimate goal of Carlisle, was to strip all the Indian culture from the Indian students. These institutions prepared boys for manual labor and farming, and girls for domestic work. The boarding school, whether on or off the reservation, carried out the government's mission, which was to restructure the Indians' minds and personalities by severing children's physical, cultural, and spiritual connections to their tribe. They were to only speak English. They were to dress in American style. They were to eat only American foods. They were to worship the God, Christian God, in the American way. And they were to live in American style houses. You can go to the Carlisle Indian School website and you can put in people's names and search, and you can pull up documents that are there. As you can see, my grandmother was student number 3,981. She attended school half days and worked and lived in the homes of white families to help the assimilation process. She was trained to clean the house and sew.
So they were confused to live with the white people and know how they live, and they taught us how to live. It seemed the kind of work that they were doing, such as cleaning house and being homemakers. And then besides, they used to pay us a little money each week. And our money used to be sent back to the school, and then during the winter time, we used to draw that money when we needed.
My grandmother went on to say that we'd get up at 4 in the morning and clean the house, then go to school at 9, and then We'd come home at 4 and do more work. These schools were extensively utilized. They also extensively utilized something that was called the outing program. And what that was they retained students for the summer and leased them out to white homes for menial labor.
Some people were good to us, and some weren't so nice. Some treated us like members of the family, and others treated us like servants. The people who treated us that way would make us do our work, and then we'd have to go to our rooms. We couldn't play with their children or go to parties.
You always run across people who make you understand you're just an Indian. She left Carlisle Indian School and returned to the reservation in 1915. She worked as a matron and sewed clothes for the children at the school in White Earth. She was married to my grandfather, William Robinson, in 1917. She recalls that everything was different when she returned to Nantahwash. The family farm was gone, and most Indians had sold their land. This was after the Clapp Amendment, which set off a buying spree as farmers from the Red River Valley, the banks, and lumbering interests moved to the reservation to buy, some say swindle, the allotments assigned to the White Earth tribal members.
On the mother's side,
Historians say that the land was sold even if the Indians were full blood, which was against the law. But if you had some white blood, then you could sell your land. So, because if you had white blood, then you were thought to have business sense. And so if you had business sense, you had to be part white. And now you could sell your land. The reality was that people were poor. They couldn't speak English. And oftentimes they were desperate. People didn't realize that they were surrendering their land titles. And all it took at that time was a thumb.
My stepfather mortgaged my land. He did for $250 to buy a team of horses. Horse and a buggy were the only thing you could travel around in at that time. The land sharks around here got land any way they could from the old people. My mother told me how she put down her thumbprint on a piece of paper she couldn't write. She couldn't speak English. My mother lost her land that way. She didn't know she was losing her allotment.
Why did they want the land? Because of timber and the agricultural land, rich land, at the White Earth Reservation. My grandmother said some people didn't know what they were putting their thumbprints down for. Some thought that they were just renting their land. A lot of people lost their land also through taxes.
I had a friend. She told me how they paid her for the allotment. They gave her a lot of dollar bills, and she put it in her apron. She thought it was a lot of money, but all it was $100 for 160 acres. The white man takes away everything from the Indians.
You always run across people who make you understand that you're just an Indian. There's a lot more to this story. A lot more. I have a handout that hopefully some of you are getting. There's more information in there. There's the original article. There's information about her basketry as well. My grandmother said, "We've never been treated right, so we take things as they come." There was nothing we could do about it, I guess. Well, my grandmother said, "We still have our Indian summer. Once in a while, they can't take that away from us." There it is. There's that resilience, right? My grandmother was an artist and a historian. She was a black ash basket maker, but she would never call herself an artist, that's for sure. She was taught black ash basketry by an Ottawa woman. In her younger years, they were at a church social at the Episcopal Church in Natahwash. This Ottawa woman, even though she couldn't speak the language, she had an axe. And she motioned for my grandmother to follow her into the woods. Now, how many of you would follow someone with an axe into the woods? Okay, well, she did. And they found a black ash tree. They took the black ash tree down, and she began pounding the tree with the back of her axe. The process began for her to make black ash baskets.
Wow.
So this was all new to her. In the early years, she recalled making her baskets to carry wild rice and fresh picked berries. She colored her splint with natural dyes that would have included choke cherries, raspberries, blueberries, blackberries. She continued her basketry into her 80s. Her baskets are in museums all across the country. And she demonstrated her baskets, like I said before, at the Smithsonian. She was in her 80s. Can you imagine taking your axe and a piece of log on the plane? That's what she did. And she would always say, in her later years, she would say, just look at those baskets. Look at the price of those baskets. That's terrible. She taught my brothers, my father, to make baskets, and the tradition continues today. You know, her story, this story, was important back in 1978 when this was written. But I think it's even more important today. The boarding school era, the loss of land and culture, it's impacted generations of Native people across this land, and we're still feeling and dealing with that trauma in untold ways today. We can't undo our history. Can't do that. But what we can do is celebrate the resilience, right? We're still here. That says a lot. And that's what I want you to remember tonight about my grandmother. She was more than a black ash basket maker. She was an artist. And her story really was told as she would weave these beautiful baskets. Picking sweet grass with Ma. Meet Ma out in the field, my mother said as she was hanging clothes out on the line. I could clearly hear her words through the screened-in porch. I was awake, just not moving. It was a sunny blue day with a breeze just perfect for adventure. Maybe later I'd walk to the beaver dam, hunt with the dogs, or explore in the garage. A day involving bolts, nuts, gears, a treasure trove of yet to be assembled ideas. Instead, it was Saturday, and I was dreading the sound of the old wringer washer and its steady song of work to be done, work to be done, calling from the kitchen. Laundry day wasn't as simple as it was today, or is today. None of the throw it in and wait until it's done. This was a process that involved many of our family to get that job done. This was work, and Saturday was laundry day. So when I heard my mother yell, "Meet Ma out in the field," I jumped at the chance to redirect my day. I smirked at that old wringer washer as I ran past. It seemed to slosh out a length of brown water trying to pull me back, but I was free. Meeting my grandmother out in the field meant that she had walked from her house, and that was about a mile away. She would be taking her time. as she always did. She never seemed to be in a rush. Hurrying wasn't a part of her nature. The closer I got to the main highway that led from Nantahala and continuing all the way into Monoman and beyond, I could hear my mother's words, "Now make sure you look both ways and make sure that dog is with you." I can still hear those words today as an adult. I guess it was good practical advice because I never got run over once. Not even close. That was good advice. There she was. I could see Ma coming across the field. I could see the familiar old lady print dress, an apron type smock that she always wore flapping in the breeze. A bandana tied around her neck meant long, hard work. My grandmother never wanted to be called grandmother. She was always Ma. To her kids, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren, just simply Ma. She was coming for a visit, and I was her escort. The closer I got to her, the more I noticed her movements. She'd take a few steps, stop, study the area, and then stoop over. And then she'd put something in her handkerchief bag. Take another step, study the area, stoop over, and put something in her bag. Her rhythm was almost as steady as that old wringer washer back at home. Work to be done. "Hey, Ma, what's in the bag?" I knew what she was doing, but I wanted to be told anyway, because I knew it was important for me to ask a question. That was my job. That was expected of me. She was picking sweetgrass for her black ash baskets. "I'm pulling grass," she said, showing me the contents of her makeshift bag. Thinking that this was an easy process, I began to pull hands full of grass, mimicking her movements, but not really sure if I was doing it the way. "No, not like that," she said. She laughed, but I think she was upset at the same time, because after all, this was for her baskets. Each piece had to be picked way down at the bottom, near the base. "Take your time," she added. "If you look carefully, you can see the difference in the grasses, and you can smell the difference." You really can. She took a blade of grass, brought it to her nose, and then to mine. She seemed to be using all her senses as she picked, and this morning became a memory, a learning experience because of the whole of it all, the baby blue sky, just the right breeze, the gathering and teaching. Within the peacefulness of it all, thinking back now, and the way of the process, this day's gathering of sweetgrass would add a special touch to her baskets and her weaving. Just the right color, length, and smell for this moment in time. Picking sweetgrass with Ma. Thank you.
This program has been funded by the Legacy Arts, Culture, and Heritage Fund of Minnesota.